Welcome to the fifth. Welcome and welcome back. It feels as if I've known you very recently, last week. And welcome back to this very special fifth week post-colonial writing and theory seminar. We have two very special guests who are not really guests, who are our very own, Elika Burma and Zoe Norwich. We also have one of our graduate students doing a reading. So you know them, but I will introduce you because we are one of the beauties of a thing like this is that the familiars made kind of pleasurably unheimlich. And I'll introduce our one of our speakers, Zoe Norwich, who is a lecturer in modern and contemporary literature at the University of York. Her current research focuses on cultural responses to genocide in memorial sites in Rwanda. She's published articles about conflict literature from Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Papua New Guinea, and also writes about cross-cultural empathy and exhibitions, photography, and dance. Her first monograph, Perceiving Pain in African Literature, is forthcoming with Palgrave Macmillan. In 2011, she was named as one of the HRC and BBC Radio 3 New Generation Thinkers, which was billed as the academic X Factor. So she's got it. At York, we know Zoe from when she was a postdoctoral fellow here at New College and the English faculty, of course, and she's at York now, and she teaches courses at global literature, African literature, conflict, and cultures of human rights. And she has previously taught for the English Department and Center for African Studies at Oxford, and also the Department of African Languages and Cultures at SOAS. I'll briefly introduce our lovely graduate student, Tamara Mollenberg, who is reading from one of Elika's works in progress, which is titled The Girl Is Also Well. And moving on to Elika herself, Elika Burma is Professor of World Literature in English at the University of Oxford. And this beautiful line in her biodata where she says she stands watchfully, if warily, at the interesting interface between creative and critical practice. So she's kind of, which is very interesting because that's exactly the sort of interface we are trying to revisit every time in this seminar series. She's the author of four acclaimed novels, Screens Against the Sky, An Immaculate Figure, Bloodlines, and Nile Baby, as well as the short story collection Sharmila and Other Portraits. Her other books, they have been path-breaking and discipline-making. They are Colonial and Postcolonial Literature, Empire, the National and the Postcolonial, Stories of Women, and the biography Nelson Mandela. She has edited Robert Baden-Powell's Scouting for Boys and the anthology Empire Writing, and co-edited Jane Coetzee in Writing and Theory. So this is a co-edited list, Terror and the Postcolonial and the Indian Postcolonial. She's currently working on a memoir fiction. Give a very big hand to these friends and wonderful academics. And
thank you very much, Anki. And it's lovely to be introduced as one of our own. I feel like I'm still here, which is, an enormous pleasure. I was very excited when Elika wrote to me about the potentials for talking about some of her new work and some of her older work for this seminar. It's lovely to focus for once on Elika's creative writing, particularly on her creative writing. And I think, looking around the room, that many of you already know her predominantly in her role as an academic. So what I wanted to do, first of all, was to have ask Elika to take us on a brief sort of journey through the text that you've written, starting off with Screens Against the Sky, coming right up to the present day with the memoir that you're currently writing. And I want you, as we go on this journey, to bear in mind that, of course, Elika was first and foremost a novelist, actually. And so Screens of the Sky, published in 1990, comes out before she gets the post at Leeds, before she goes and takes up her first permanent post. And so that's the position from which we're starting off, but we're of course going to go on a winding path through all of her critical writing as well, but focusing mostly on the creative. Over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, Anki, for the lovely introduction, and thank you to Zoe for putting yourself through this and for having very I don't know, heroically worked through all this fictional work of mine. It's a slightly formidable context for me, this. It involves something of a change of role or of hat or of voice, and I've no idea whether it will work, but with Zoe as my guide, I'm sure it'll be okay. Zoe is the X factor.
The local celebrity.
Anyway, Zoe came to this observation about Screens Against the Sky coming out before my thesis was examined, and a month before I finished writing my doctoral thesis. And I too, in thinking ahead to this forum today, had thought that might be something to bring out for you folks, because running the idea of the seminar past a couple of you in the last few weeks, that has been something that several people have picked up on. You know, how in terms of my actual practice have these two modes knitted together or unfolded in dialogue? And that also, I think, probably involves talking a little bit about, which might be interesting to some of you, the value placed on creative writing in the academy, both then, when I think some of you are still in nappies, 1990, and now. I wrote Screens Against the Sky in the summer, ending the second year of my doctorate, because that is probably one of the most difficult times in a doctorate, and I had hit a wall. I couldn't go further with the kind of writing I was doing, sort of this analytics, critical, cerebral, stepping back from a situation and talking about it from the outside. Already then, although it was hard at Oxford at that time, it was before Robert Young had arrived and taken his post here at Wadham. At that time, post-colonial perspectives, if you like, were not welcome or indeed even recognized here in the university. So I was kind of having to make up the discourse as I went along. And writing about nation of the other from this perspective without. So what I did was I took 3 months off. I didn't tell my supervisor, and I wrote Screens Against the Sky, and it was one of those lucky books. It was almost immediately picked up and published and had wonderful reviews. And I suppose for a period of time it was very intoxicating, very giddy making to have been involved with that. And arrived then at, as Zoe has called up for us, arrived then at Leeds with a novel, as it were, in my back pocket, and a DPhil about to be examined, and was met by my head of department saying, that's all very well, that creative work, but now you need to write some real books. And it was probably one of the most traumatic and upsetting dialogues that lasted about 10 minutes of my entire life. And, you know, if you like, the whole of these last 20 years have been a process of 21 years have been a process of thinking my way through that and thinking my way around that and coming to an understanding of the value of creative discourse. I mean, all these terms are so unwieldy. The writing of narrative as itself a diagnostic activity, as itself a mode of analysis, as a way of thinking through a problem. Or thinking through an emotion, or thinking through a situation. And so I'm delighted now, and this is, I'm still sort of in the mode of academic prose, but I'm delighted now to be involved in a process within the research enhancement framework, the REF, to which all of us academics are subject, whereby creative practice, creative writing, is being revalued as absolutely equivalent to an academic monograph. So this is, you know, this is something that's been quite an achievement and something that I've been deeply invested in. Okay, so that was just by way, I don't know, of a credo, I suppose. But I suppose what that has also involved is that in my creative work subsequent to 1990, I have had the tendency, and I do see this from the vantage point of critic as well as writer, I have had the tendency to write what some have called programmatic prose or programmatic narrative, you know, as Keats might say, stories that have a design upon us. You know, there's if you like, my terror book, you know, my terror novel, and then, you know, some years later I publish academically on terror, or you know, I've written about the iconography of the female, and I published an Immaculate Figure. So there's been this, if you like, a dialogue, but that has also been at the risk of a programmatic tendency to, I think, to some of my creative work, which I hope I'm working through and getting away from. Although the other day, this wonderful Chinese translator who's hoping to translate Nile Baby into Chinese wrote to me to say that she finds that my sentences fizz with post-colonial energy. I think, which she meant my narrative sentences. So I think maybe there's still something of that there. But there has, it's been something that I've been, and I can talk more about this as we go along, that what it is to write in the two modes, and what it is to keep them apart or not to keep them apart, and the difficulty of that, and often the real pain of that, as well as sometimes the joy. So we can talk more about that. But that's probably enough in terms of the pathway.
Yeah, I love this idea of fizzing with post-colonial energy, and it makes me think of the interview you had with John Masterson as well, where I think he was fizzing with post-colonial energy responding to your text. And for those, it's available now, isn't it, for people to read?
Yeah, it's in a book called Black Europe. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lovely dialogue about the post-colonial elements in Nile Baby, and he kind of insistently asks you whether you have them in mind, I think, as you're constructing the text, and you consistently say no, actually. They might reflect some of my critical thoughts, but it comes from a creative urge rather than necessarily a critical standpoint. We're going to be talking mostly about Bloodlines, Nile Baby, and Sharmila, and perhaps the new text a little bit. So for those people in the room who haven't necessarily read all of those texts, do you want to sort of give a snapshot into each of them, just as a sort of a cornerstone, so people will know where we are?
Yeah, this is sort of part B of the opening question. So Screens Against the Sky, these are just very, very swift snapshots. Screens Against the Sky is a mother-daughter story. An Immaculate Figure, I was trying out something new. I don't think it worked. I was trying out a kind of high-tailing adventure story involving, I don't know, a kind of James Bond subplot. As I said, I was working through ideas of how women are represented and objectified. And then Bloodlines, as I sort of hinted, is a book about an act of terror that impacts on the different characters involved, the perpetrator, the victims, the relatives of the victims, the friends of the victims in different ways. And where am I? Nile Baby is my first and to date only novel set in England, and it involves two child protagonists and a great deal of haunting, haunting by the past, haunting by their own particular preoccupations, and it's a bit of I wanted a kind of a road movie element, so sort of a I wanted to as a open out the fairly restricted dimensions of this island, this mainland of Britain, by taking these two children and their Nile baby, their sort of doppelganger figure, on a journey through the UK. So that's, there you go.
Thank you very much. And Sharmila, of course, is the collection of short stories as well, sort of collected together, mostly set in South Africa, I think, and the autumn set in South Africa. I wanted to begin thinking perhaps a little bit more about this idea of writing as a way of thinking through a problem, because it comes back again and again in your work. And let's take the last published piece, in some ways, the epilogue to Sharmila, to the collection of short stories. In Sharmila, you state, "My Anglophile but Netherlands-born father hurt me, not into a form, but a language, English, and that this has ultimately committed me to a certain mode of writing, to prose, not poetry." That's quite complicated, so I'll just read it one more time. So in the epilogue, you write, "My Anglophile but Netherlands-born father hurt me, not into a form, but a language, English, and this has ultimately committed me to a certain mode of writing, to prose rather than poetry." And this statement, for me, reminds me a little bit of Shoshana Feldman's sort of foundational text, which you have in your hand, Testimony, that Shoshana Feldman wrote this text with Dori Laub, and it's about the role of testimony in writing, really. And in the very first chapter, she has this section looking at Mallarmé. Mallarmé, the French poet, arriving to give a lecture here in Oxford, announces to his audience that they have done violence to verse. And she translates this from the French into English in her own words, Feldman does. She translates Mallarmé saying, "They have done violence to verse. It is appropriate to relieve myself of that news right away, to talk about it now already, much like an invited traveller who, without delay, in breathless gasps, discharges himself of the testimony of an accident known and pursuing him." And then Feldman goes on at that point to talk about the disintegration of the Alexandrine, to talk about the development from French away from this kind of very constricting form into much more free verse. And the idea that the accident is written into poetry, the idea that poetry, when it becomes out of that kind of closed structure, becomes much more surprising, becomes it's more confronting. And that he's talking about that being in somehow violent, that the violence is bound up within the unpredictability of that language at that point. And the doing violence to language just kind of really resonated for me when I was referring to your phrase and the idea of your father hurting you into language. I was going to say, can you respond to that? Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which violence is bound up in language and the ways in which you work through that problem, and perhaps a bit about the overlap between language and genre, between language and form for you?
Okay, I think it's a truism to say, and I think it's sheltering there behind what Mallarmé is saying, that certain languages, because of their literary traditions, carry with them different generic imperatives. So, I think there are certain languages that lend themselves more to, if you like, the lyric form or to epic, or indeed to free verse. I think English is a language that lends itself to free verse. Mm-hmm. I think, though, what I was pushing at in that quote that you brought out there is not so much doing violence in language, but doing violence with language. Mm-hmm. And I should also say that to be bilingual, I'm sure the other people in the room who are bilingual or trilingual would agree with me, to be bilingual is an amazing gift. And I owe it to my dad, who forced me, that's implied by the violence, who forced me to learn English from a very young age. To have, as it were, two linguistic neural pathways in operation at any one time is a marvelous boon for a writer, for a critic, to always have those two resources at hand. I think it's slightly different from learning a language a bit later. I learned French when I was about sort of 11, and it's always, as it were, in a third position. Bilingualism, something that fascinates me and something that I find an important boon. But the way in which it happened was a violent act of inflicting a language from a violent man. So, you know, doing violence with rather than within language, I think, is something that I was pushing to there. And how that represented a loss, while also being a gain because of what I've said about bilingualism, is that some of the marvelous resources of Dutch, which after all is Nederlands, I prefer to call it, which is a minority language, but it's like German to some extent. It's agglutinative, to me very visceral, very very graphic in some ways. Those resources were downgraded or to some extent displaced. And I think there are resources that one might use more for poetry than one might for prose. English always strikes me as something of a rational language. I mean, I know that's often said of French in respect of English, but or in comparison with English, but English is a distant, it's a very cool language, whereas Dutch is a warm, clustering, agglutinative language, and one in which I could only write poetry. You know, mm-hmm. I couldn't do it in English, I don't think. So, yeah, but I'm sure this resonates for those of you in the room who have, you know, access to several tongues, if you like, from an early age.
How does your Dutch sort of bubble into your English now? Does it still come through? And I'm thinking particularly perhaps of the way in which you use the in your writing about the girl and the father and the mother in some of the short stories in Shamara. And elsewhere. And also perhaps you would like to comment, I wonder whether you'd like to comment on the way in which you describe that language in itself, because we spoke earlier about how occasionally you refer to Netherlands, other times Netherlands, other times Dutch. Mm-hmm. What are the politics of the language choices there as well?
Okay,
well, not
so
necessarily
the,
politics, but the
so the question is, sorry, so the first bit was...
So the question is twofold. The first bit is, how does Dutch influence your English writing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
how
yeah,
does the
yeah,
Dutch
yeah,
voice
okay.
come through in your English yeah. writing? And then how do you in English refer explicitly to the Dutch? So what is implicit and what is explicit, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, I might have reason to use this response at other points in this dialogue, but I think in a way that's to an extent for others to say and see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting what you just said about the. I do think, because for those of you who know Germanic languages, I mean, I know English is a Germanic language, but it's highly, highly creolized. For those of you who know Germanic languages, the verb is always driven to the end of the sentence, right? Right to the end of the sentence. And I do think that in my prose, I have this tendency, very annoying to me. It creates a sort of deep sense of nausea when I'm working through a sentence, of front-loading the sentence with clauses when I'm writing in English.
Mm.
But I'm giving you a very sort of material kind of practical,
yeah.
you know, response. But the if you like the meat of the sentence, the action is pushed right towards the end, and that makes my prose, and this is something I can't stand because I believe in clear writing, quite wordy. There's a sort of a thicket of verbiage you have to move through in order to get to the action at the end. I think that's, if I, you know, speaking as a supervisor, I think that's a Dutch feature, if you like, of my of my written English. I mean, I always, and again, I read up a lot about, or read a lot about bilingualism, wherever I can sort of, you know, hunt it out. And I understand that this is something that other bilingual people suffer. I'm never quite sure, especially when tired or in stressful situations, whether I'm being fully grammatical in English.
That you can slip between grammars, that you'll be speaking in English but wondering whether you're implying using
yeah.
the Dutch
yeah.
grammar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can imagine that. Okay.
Oh, and sorry, and then part B. Well, I mean, Dutch is not the word that Nederlands people use of their language. You know, I mean, I suppose you know you could say that of other languages, but it is Dutch has such negative connotations in English. You know, Dutch courage and going Dutch, and it's you know. So I prefer to use the word that Nederlands people use, which is Nederlands or Netherlands, if in English.
Yeah. Perhaps an example of that slippage is that you use Netherlands and Nederlands in the mm-hmm. same stories that you go back and forth between mm-hmm. the two of them. Mm-hmm. Thinking back to kind of the genre question that I was trying to tie in at the very mm-hmm. beginning, but I can see very much from your answer they are separate. But thinking back to genre, in Bloodlines you refer to poetry as being distanced from the world.
Mm-hmm.
You write... And this is the main character, Anthea. Anthea is working as a journalist at the time, and there's just been a bomb blast in the place where she is working. And she writes, all that time studying late Victorian poetry, she saw so clearly now, it just hadn't enough to do with this drama, the world out here. The carved shapes of the poems created a pathway to somewhere else, a misty obscurity, a place of suspended responsibility that was supremely peaceful, worlds apart.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, is there by contrast an urgency to prose? And I'm asking this, you know, in the knowledge that we have that there is so much extraordinary poetry coming out of South Africa and out of elsewhere. But is there a sense of historical relevancy and perhaps immediacy that you find appealing in prose and that kind of comes through in that journalistic voice sometimes as well that Anthea inhabits?
Mm. Well, I mean, Anthea is not a mouthpiece.
Yeah.
I would differ from her sharply on that question, because I think that poetry, in fact, especially where poetry moves over to or tends to on that spectrum that poetry inhabits, tends to song or tends to chanting or tends to declamation, I think poetry actually is in a lot of ways much more immediate and much more of the moment and able sort of to enter a situation than prose is. Prose takes so much more graft. You know, it's forgive me, poets in the room, because poetry is also very, very involves a great deal of labour. But it's just the sheer graft of, if you like, if you write longhand, of pushing the hand across those hundreds of pages, or if you know. This labour. I would differ there. There's something. I mean, as I was also saying about, you know, the agglutinative qualities of Dutch, which fit poetry much more than they do prose. I do think there's something very visceral and grainy about poetry that narrative fiction doesn't necessarily have, can have, but doesn't necessarily have.
Okay. Can I pick up on the idea of graft, of work?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Bloodlines in beautiful ways animates the concept of work, animates the concept of writing as work. Because Anthea is trying to write stories, first obituaries of her partner, who it turns out dies in the bomb blast. And then she's trying to write a history, a history of, it turns out, the family of the man who did the bombing, but in which lots of people are bound up. And that begins to become quite a collaborative project. So whereas she starts it on her own, actually she gets involved with the bomber's mother and they start writing together. And I found this fascinating, particularly given the time it comes out. It comes out around 2000. Mm. I'm thinking about it as contemporaneous with Anki Kroc's Country of My mm-hmm. Skull. Yet another person who I think grapples with poetry, prose mm-hmm. ideas again mm-hmm. and again and again, mm-hmm. grapples with Afrikaans mm-hmm. English, of course mm-hmm. different to mm-hmm. Dutch English, but with the question of Afrikaans. But her project, I don't think, involves collaboration to quite the extent that yours does. Do you want to say something about the extraordinary nature of that collaboration?
I think there are different ways into this answer, and I'm not sure I can cover them all. But it just seemed to me, thinking through ways of suturing historical pain or ways of working through that the idea of writing not as a lone activity, but of something that involved a call and response, mm-hmm. or a back and forth, or an integration of perspectives, was somehow, maybe this is the programmatic side, I'm not sure, but it was somehow much more interesting as a medium than the idea of, you know, writing a part or writing a single track narrative without the combination of voices. Because I mean, I think it's worth saying in Bloodlines that it isn't until one of the protagonists, this Anthea character, is able to collaborate on a retelling of the past with the bomber's mother. It isn't until that point that she realizes that unless that collaboration takes place, there is going to be no story.
Mm.
Yeah, so the story is contingent on the collaboration.
Collaborations and friendships seem to come back quite a bit in your work, because Nile Baby also centres around a collaboration that in many ways involves creating stories. How did you find yourself thinking into those very different voices, those child voices in Nile Baby? Nile Baby is looking at two 12-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
are they 12?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about things together. How did you think yourself into that voice and to the UK setting in particular?
The UK setting wasn't hard. And the that's John, another writer. Nile Baby was important. I mean, perhaps I need to preface this answer by saying that to me, I'm reiterating something I already said before. To me, what is fascinating about the process of, and draws me back again and again, even when there's no time and these kinds of activities are devalued, what is fascinating about the writing process is that it allows the writer into the place of the other. I mean, that is, it's huge. I mean, obviously, it's a fiction, and it's a composition, it's a construction, it's a projection, and yet it does very, this word again, viscerally allow the writer to think from the place of the other. So with the two children, I mean, I had two others living in my house, as in my two children, one of whom was very close to the age of the protagonist. So as it were, I had a native informant kind of present in the room who was able to do a lot of reality checking for me. I would run sentences by him, and it was so interesting to think about a situation from the child's eye view, and then no longer to be thinking of a situation from the child's eye view, but to be thinking that situation within that view. That was, you know, where the child was. In that case, the other, and where the child was, the two child protagonists were also trying to get to another place themselves in the form of the dead fetus that they're carrying around with them.
Can I ask a question that sounds
which makes it sound a bit gothic, but
yeah.
Yeah.
When you were describing that, it almost sounded a bit like sort of character acting, a kind of a complete immersion in the character. Do you inhabit these children when you're writing their voices, or do you remain in your position imagining them?
Well, it's a dual. It's dual. I'm sure many people in this room have tried this out themselves. When you deep, especially when you're writing first person. And it doesn't matter if it's present or past tense, but you know, if you're writing first person, you are deeply inside that other consciousness. You have to be, or it won't work. And so that's what I suppose I'm referring to when I say writing from the place of the other. But at the same time, of course, you're still, you know, feeling your visceral bodily needs as a human being in the present moment. You know, you need to go off and make yourself a cup of tea or what have you. So there is always that give and take, that dual process in play. And it pertains when you're writing third person too. You know, it is. And I suppose this is one of the answers that I might give to the question that often comes up. I know, Zoe, that you're not going to ask it, so, but I'll just anticipate it here. A question that comes up as to why a person such as myself, who, you know, I'm sort of, as it were, perfectly competent in an academic medium, why I should want to do this other stuff too, you know, to engage in this mess, this clutter of, if you like, narrative prose. And it's partly because, if you like, this is just, you know, one answer again amongst several possible answers. It's because it allows that almost total embodiment of another character, their body, their world, their perspective. Because, you know, what I suppose we post-colonialists are all about is that, you know, that reflecting on otherness.
Yes. Which, from what you've told me, I think ties into what David was talking about last week in relation to empathy and, mm-hmm. and Einfühlung and the idea of literally inhabiting the other's perspective, and perhaps creative writing provides the ultimate answer to that in a way that critical writing doesn't, which he posed at the beginning as a problematic as well. On that note, I was wondering, can we go to Tamara to have a couple of extracts? These extracts are both from the new memoir, the new book that Elika is writing. Mm-hmm. Do you want to introduce it, or are you going to?
I think they've been chosen by Zoe, and they kind of standalone pieces, very well chosen. They're from the first part of the book that they've not been read aloud before. So I've no idea how they might sound. And I do want to emphasize it's work in progress, okay? So I may have the urge, which is why it's helpful to have Tamara's voice, and thanks so much, Tamara, for agreeing to have Tamara's voice reading, because it sort of objectifies it a little. So the first one, the first one is Remedial, and shall we do that one first and then maybe...
Yeah.
Okay. So what's going on here? It's just as I say, as Anki was saying, the work is provisionally called the Girl Is Also Well, and here you see a process of learning taking place.
The Remedial group begins each day singing clap along songs. After that, the girl is allowed to sit by herself and draw for as long as she likes. It doesn't matter what. A tortoise, a fish with a long tail, a whale. Then, in the hour before lunch, Mrs. Wood writes short words like bat and dog on the blackboard. She invites the class to say the words along with her, clapping at the same time. Bat, dog, dog, bat, as if it was a game. This is the girl's favorite lesson. Exactly the method taught at Steiner schools back home, that you'll be taught when next we go and stay, says the mother one afternoon when she catches the girl skipping to the chant, bat, dog, bat, dog. Do you remember the Steiner school I pointed out to you last time in Nederland, behind the dune on the Skyveningenweg? That was my school. The girl finds a way of making her favorite lessons go further. Each one, she sees, can bring something new. One day she is chanting dog and bat, the next cap and can, the following week mat and pot. Each day's lessons become building blocks she can put on top of yesterday's. She still doesn't know what she is doing here in the remedial class. No one has yet said a thing to explain, not Mrs. Wood, not the mother or the father, not Mr. Shute. Mr. Shute in his polished shoes, who at the end of the first term is promoted to a job in the education department and disappears from the school overnight. At home, not a word is spoken on the subject of the remedial class, and the girl does not say a word. If the mother and the father helped send her here, she thinks, well, let them sit and stew. Let them wonder in vain how she's doing. She won't tell them a thing. She begins to piece together the lettering she can see around the classroom. The word chart that lies open on Mrs. Wood's lap, the fire safety instructions, the equipment list stuck on the first aid cabinet. Morning, fire drill, bandage. She joins A, B, and C together in different patterns in her jotter pad and makes C-A-B, a proper English word. Little by little, she adds more letters and makes more words. B-A-D, B-E-D-C-A-T. Soon the separate words start fitting into strings of meaning. C-A-B-A-N-D-B-A-T. C-A-N-Y-O-U-B-A-T. At night, the mother reads her stories from English books in her broken English. The father tells her to. The girl's eye races ahead. She is listening to the mother, but at the same time, she's reading the words she recognizes further down the page. The girl suspects she's the only child in the remedial class who can read more than bat, cab, and cap in Mrs. Wood's handwriting on the board, apart from wordless Naomi Salome, perhaps, who can do all kinds of things but gives nothing away. Even so, she's a woven-in part of the class. In the remedial class, no one tells on her for copying, frowns at her pictures. When she's been in the remedial class a month or two, the girl begins to rock in time with her classmates sitting on the carpet. She notices this offhand, not minding. She especially likes rocking when they are chanting words. Rocking, she feels more a part of the group. She feels so much part of the group that when she catches sight of herself in the hallway mirror at the end of the first term, it is as if the widow's peak in the middle of her forehead that she gets from her father's side has stretched into a houndstooth wedge, just the same as Dan's. With trial and error, the girl cultivates on the carpet her own special remedial pastimes. After some weeks of combing the pink and blue nylon surface with her fingers and harvesting the fluff, she settles for chewing the skin around her nails and biting them raw. She begins with her hands. Then, when the summer heat arrives and the children who aren't normally shoeless can wear sandals, she applies her teeth to the calluses on the sides of her toes and the backs of her heels. To get the chewiest bits front on, she bends over double. This position has the added advantage of making it easier to rock in time with the others than when she is sitting up straight. To and fro she goes, to and fro. The wobbly man in the naughty books Mrs. Wood reads them has nothing on her. Overall, life is not bad in the remedial class. In the playground, though, it is a different story. Now the Bureau War is the least of the girl's worries. Now, as she walks across the field after lunch to locate her remedial classmates, the boys from her former class make deadpan eyes at her and stretch their lips into a silly grimace. For a while, she can't think what the grimace means. Then she works it out from the tightness in her cheeks that they are mimicking her own silly face, the staring, listening look she has, set like a shield. "Ellie belly," they shout. "Head's all jelly, jelly head, jelly belly." It had to happen, the girl tells herself, sooner or later. Sooner or later, the older children would spot the drooling monster that lives inside her. On her forehead is a mark of Cain as big and ugly as Dan's.
Also talks to you as a monster there. Yes. There's a
yeah.
And you send it to include the monster at the end, which I think is lovely.
Okay.
Should we go straight on
it
and then talk?
Should you the other one too? Yeah. Are you okay, yeah. Tamara? Yeah. Yeah. Great. Okay. Off you go. Yeah. It's so.
Can I just say while we'll be making up what an extraordinary privilege it is to read this. This before it's come out. Mm-hmm. I think it's really exciting to hear it as a work in progress, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it in print and seeing how it works. So, yeah.
Okay. So this one.
So this is a later scene when the mother and the child are returning from Holland to South Africa, and the mother has a terrible fear of flying, and it's a scene describing that fear of flying and the way in which she's held.
Okay. I don't speak Dutch, so I apologize.
Because the truth is, she doesn't mind flying. She likes being swept up high while feeling safely strapped in. She thinks of the plane boring through the sky ahead like a rocket. Locked inside herself, she looks out of the window at the stars, feeling the tightness of the belt across her front. ignoring the mother completely. But these are thoughts for the Schiphol ladies' toilet. Once they're in the plane, it is a different story. When Ma'am grabs the girl's hands, undoes her seatbelt, stands upright and starts yelling, it's impossible to blank her. When air stewards come running to force her back into her seat, she can't pretend they don't belong together. Yes, she nods when they ask. Yes, I will hold my mother's arm. I will try to help her stay in her seat when she panics. I will ask her to keep her seatbelt fastened. Blanking the mother is hardest when the plane meets with tropical storms. Around the equator, the turbulence is often bad, but for noise and bumpiness, the thunderstorms over West Africa take first prize. Hurtling its way north or south over the bulge of the continent, the DC-8 is tossed like a rubber ball from thunderhead to thunderhead, or so it feels. Lightning bounces off the plane wings and zigzags. The mother crouches by the emergency exit, retching, beating the door with her hands. Mutter, oh Mutter, the mother cries. Oh, my Mutterji, my life. The passengers adjust their eye masks, light up a fresh cigarette. The girl checks that her seatbelt is fastened. She sits on her hands and fixes her eyes on the slow, blue spiral rising from the passenger smoking in the row ahead. She wishes she might watch the lightning, but the mother has pushed the window shutter down. For all that, she believes the mother will now really die. For all that she believes the mother will now really die, just as she has long threatened to do, she doesn't want to reach down to her. She doesn't want to. She won't. If she did, she might want to shut her up. She might want to clap her hand over her mouth and make her stop her terrible yelling. More than anything, she wants to stop that noise. During one of the storms of the Bulge, a white-lit electric storm of about an hour out of Accra, the girl makes a discovery. There is an accident, and she makes a discovery. Woken by the turbulence, the mother that night falls suddenly to the ground. As she drops, she strikes with her strong Dutch forearm a passenger in the aisle seat opposite. She doesn't mean to, of course. Her arm, her whole body, drops down out of control. But the sleeping passenger, jolted, cries out in shock. Within seconds, a bump appears on her forehead. Her husband beside her leans on the call button. The girl watches from her seat as the mother, held down by two air stewards, has a syringe of clear fluid pressed and asked for into her arm. When a passenger becomes a danger to others, one of the air stewards says, glances uncomfortably at the girl. She looks away, raises the shutter. Out in the night, the clouds are on fire. The sky is silver. That second she looks away, something in the girl's heart hardens and turns sharp. The woman lying unconscious on the floor, her mouth gargling, she decides, doesn't belong to her. She and this woman don't belong together. She wants to block her nose at the meaty smell of fear rising from her body. If she'd look at her, she'd want to cough out the disgust sitting like a lump of mucus in her throat. As if they have read the girl's thoughts, two air stewards take the mother's arms over their necks and half drag, half walk her to a seat behind a curtain at the front of the plane. The girl pulls out the coloring pad she was given earlier by the air stewardess serving dinner. The pad comes along with a pencil cunningly tucked into the spiral binding of the pad. There are blank pages at the back of the pad. For your own drawing, say the printed words at the top. On the first blank page, she writes, either we fall out of the sky or we don't. Either way, no amount of crying will help. She reads what she has written. She likes it. It makes sense and sounds wise. Reading her two sentences, she has a picture of their plane up high in the sky, above the clouds, suspended, as if balanced on a pinnacle of thin air. Something about this thought gives her perspective. She writes a few more things. Up in the air, she writes, middle of a storm, inside a bubble. The effect is wonderful. This is her discovery. Anything she writes down, whatever it is, one word after another, it turns things quiet. What was noisy evens out, looks suddenly level and smooth. Ma'am lying there like a beast, she writes, a dumb beast. The disgust she felt seeing her injected ebbs away. This isn't like when she wrote nonsense rhymes when she was smaller, when she chanted alliterating chains. Then she was inside the rhyme, absorbed by it. Now she is inside and outside the words, cut in two, separated from herself, but steady within herself, calm. There, over on that side of herself, the part of her that is being written about still feels what, a moment ago, the rest of her was feeling. Here, over on this side, she is writing what happens. Here, everything is at a distance, but everything at the same time is under her control. She so much likes the effect of the writing that for the next couple of hours, she goes on putting down words with her pencil. Any old words, really, like zoo and beast and hate. Until long after the overhead lights have been switched off, she makes up sentences with the words. I hate to see her lying there like a zoo beast. She wonders about the word hate. It comes without thinking about it. Possibly she doesn't mean it, but it gives her relief to write it. The words squeeze from her fingers as if of their own accord. She feels like a ventriloquist's apprentice who has practiced to the point of exhaustion, or so she imagines it, who has voices swirling through him, popping at random out of his mouth.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Tara.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tara. Two very clear, lovely, evocative readings. Thank you. So perhaps you can suspect why we asked Tamara, why I suggested those passages and why we wanted to talk about them, because in the first one, this passage about this the girl who is being described being in the remedial class, I think it's fascinating the way in which she embodies language and that she internalizes sort of words, and that when it's talking about them, all the movement and the swaying and so on, the idea that that swaying with language makes her part of a group, but it also in some ways makes her part of a group that makes her other from the other groups. And she's already been in this story, she's already been isolated from the main class. This is why she's sent to remedial class, because she's laughed at, isolated, ridiculed in the main class, and then sent to the remedial class. So through unconventional ways into language, she finds some kind of collective identity. And then in this second piece, I find it fascinating because I think that it harks back to the earlier piece and the idea when it talks about at the end there, which when you're reading, about how it's different, how she talks about being inside of rhymes, inside of poetry when she's jumping, when her mother catches her saying those words, the cat bed words, when she's doing skipping exercises and so on, she feels like she's inside language. But when she writes about it, and I'm going back to this poetry prose thing, I'm sorry, I've got this in my head. Then she kind of, when she writes that into sentences, she feels a sort of a distancing and a control that takes place. Do you want to comment on that as a process in relation to this child character, in relation to the way in which the child begins to gain control over her own life in relation to language?
In a way, I have. I mean, I think in those pieces. Maybe just as a footnote, though, that way in which, and I mean, a number of a whole range of writers have written about this, but that writing is not just not just a thought process. It is very visceral. It is an embodied act, as is voice. You know, voice is so much of the body, but so too is writing. That's probably enough.
Okay.
On that, maybe we could.
Do you want to open it up?
Yeah. Should we?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We can always come back and do some more. But these folks have been very quiet for a long time, so we could.
Absolutely. Do you want? Shall I check questions? Anki, do you want to?
Can we just have a round of clapping first, and then. Yeah.